Are you thirsty? The American writer Samuel Clemens, or is better known as Mark Twain, wrote once that he was very tired of all the discord he saw in the world. And so he built a cage, and in it he put a dog and a cat. After a little training, he writes, I got the dog and the cat to the point where they live peaceably together. He continues on. Then I introduced a pig, a goat, a kangaroo, some birds, and a monkey. And after a few adjustments, they learned to live together in the cage in harmony. So I was encouraged by this. And so I added an Irish Catholic, a Presbyterian, a Jew, a Muslim from Turkestan, a Buddhist from China, along with a Baptist missionary that I had captured on some trip. And in a very short while, there wasn't a single living thing left in that cage. Now, as humorous as this little piece by Mark Twain is, it's also sadly quite reflective of our world, isn't it? I know I'm not alone in my assessment that there is something disturbing and very sinister and dark building in our world right now. Tensions created by differences among people have always been present, but it seems that those who promote bias, hatred, and xenophobia are becoming bolder. How else do you explain the growing power of the far-right political parties in Europe and the racial discrimination that has been exercised by the American government in the guise of national security? Canada is not innocent in this. Saudi Arabia is one of the worst offenders of human rights on this planet. Its lack of equality for women is well known, but what is often forgotten is that the Saudi government persecutes religious minorities, including other Muslim sects. Did you know that our government last year approved the delivery of 1,000 light armored vehicles to the Saudi government at a cost of $15 billion? And in the meantime, the Saudis began a bombing campaign in Yemen that has killed 10,000 people and left 3 million more acutely malnourished, and out of which 450,000 are children who are at the risk of dying from malnutrition and diarrhea. 7 million people in Yemen now don't know where their next meal is going to come from. And this is just one example of many of the sectarian-driven violence that occurs every day in this messed up world. When this passage of John 4 came up in our service schedule, I could have taken a lot of different tracks to preach on. But then I realized that before us today is Jesus' approach to ethnic and religious differences. Did you realize that? When confronting isolationist policies and feeling fearful of those who espouse different ideas and beliefs than we do, we have John 4 as the answer to the question, what would Jesus do? And what Jesus does in John 4 rocked his disciples to their core. It challenged contemporary Jewish religious leaders, and he walked headlong into centuries-old ethnic conflicts. It all began when we read that Jesus wanted to go back to his home territory in Galilee from Judea, and he decided to take the most direct route. In other words, Jesus had to go through Samaria. Let's stop right there. Jesus and his disciples go through Samaria. Samaria. No good Jew in Jesus' day would ever willingly go into the area of Samaria. When they traveled from Judea to Galilee or the other way around, Jews most often would detour around Samaria, even if it made the trip longer. Although Jews and Samaritans shared many beliefs and much of the same ancient history, they despised each other. Do you remember that famous parable that we call the Good Samaritan? Everybody knows that story. Anyone hearing that story the day Jesus first told it would be confused and probably offended, because the idea that a Samaritan was the one who was portrayed as the pious person and the kind person was offensive to Jewish listeners. It seems odd because the Jews and the Samaritans shared history, but as hated as the Romans were, some Romans actually were accepted into Jewish society. You remember the Roman centurion and the sick servant in Matthew 8? Well, that's just one example. Samaritans, however, were considered an embarrassment to the Jewish people. The Jews didn't want Samaritans just out of sight. They wanted them wiped from the face of the earth. So again, I point out how shocking it is that Jesus takes a trip through Samaria. The disciples, and it's not a stretch to think this, the disciples would have had knots in their stomachs that intensified with each step they took that took them in further into Samaria. And then Jesus creates even further embarrassment for his disciples by stopping at Jacob's well and talking to a Samaritan woman. It was bad enough to walk through this territory, but to actually stop and talk to someone, and a woman at that. So why one wonders, why were the Samaritans, who still exist, believe it or not, today, although their numbers only are about 650 people, why were they hated so much by the Jews? Well, the woman at the well points us to the heart of the matter when she says to Jesus, who she knows is a Jew, which is a very rare sight in her village, "Are you greater than our father Jacob, who gave us this well?" Well, Jacob, of course, was the one who was renamed Israel. His 12 sons became the 12 tribes of Israel. The Samaritans were named after the famous city in the Old Testament that was called Samaria. It was the capital of the northern half of the Jewish divided kingdom. Samaritans generally believe they are descendants of Joseph and Levi, while those in the southern kingdom of Judah considered themselves to be descendants of Judah, Benjamin, or Levi. Even though both kingdoms came from the same forefather, Jacob, scholars know that there were several cultural and religious differences between these two groups. Even when David ruled the United Kingdoms, King David, Samaria was always a thorn in his side. There was rebellion and civil war that came out of Samaria. And the Assyrians, for their part, they took 20 years to finally conquer that northern kingdom. And when it was finally conquered, all the land was lost to Assyria except Samaria. The Assyrians took a lot of people into captivity, and then they took to replacing those people with other foreigners, other foreign groups. And those new people became assimilated into the Samaritan culture. When Judah, the southern kingdom, was taken away by Babylon, the Samaritans had lost the only temple they had ever known, so they decide they're going to build a new temple on Mount Gerizim, and it was there that they worshiped God. When the Judeans came back to Jerusalem, as recorded in the book of Nehemiah, they rebuilt the temple in Jerusalem. And thus a long, bitter fight ensued as to which temple, which church, is the right one. So we have two groups that read the Torah and worship God, but they did not share a recent history around Jesus' time, nor did they worship in the same place. Their fight was really not about religious differences, but rather it was about who were the true descendants of Jacob, who were God's people. Near the end of the 2nd century B.C., the Jews came to Samaria and destroyed the temple at Mount Gerizim. They were led by the Maccabean ruler John Hyrcanus, and he also conquered the Samaritans and ruled them for many years. So when Jesus walks into that village of Sychar, remember all of this, and he sits at that well, he's walked into decades, centuries of bitterness and hatred and prejudice. When Jesus asked the woman for a drink of water, she's shocked. She's indignant. Why would a Jew ask a Samaritan for anything, let alone a drink of water? On the basis of the fact that Jesus and this woman are from differing factions of religious life, and she is an unaccompanied woman, that should have been enough to prevent any interaction between Jesus and this woman. But Jesus is not done revealing taboos here. Knowing full well the woman's life situation, he tells her to go and call her husband and come back. Because culturally, she shouldn't be talking to Jesus without a male relative present. That was cultural. But Jesus wants to acknowledge something else, doesn't he? She replies that she has no husband. And Jesus states that she's answered correctly, and actually she's had five husbands, and currently she's with a man who isn't her husband. Jesus has revealed her secret. He's also shone a light onto another reason that Jesus shouldn't have been talking to this woman. She's a social outcast of her own people. Why else does she come to the well alone and at noon? In those days, water was collected in the early morning when it was cool, and the women would all go at the same time to collect the water for their households because that was their time to socialize and swap news from the village. The woman Jesus meets is a social pariah. She's shunned. She was likely the topic of much of that conversation around the well. Frankly, hers was a hard life. It was. By all definitions, she was, in the Jewish mind, unworthy of anyone's attention. Hence the reaction of the disciples in verse 27. They come back and they find Jesus talking to this woman, and they're astonished, they're shocked. The revelation of her life situation floors the woman, who discerns that Jesus is a prophet, but then Jesus does something he rarely does in all the Gospels. You know, remember often in the Gospels, Jesus would ask people he healed not to tell anyone what happened to them. You remember that? And then he often would use the term son of man instead of son of God. Here to the Samaritan woman, Jesus clearly identifies himself as the Messiah, the one whom both Jews and Samaritans have been waiting for. The woman runs off back to the village to tell her fellow villagers about Jesus, saying, maybe this guy's the Messiah. And the people rush out, and we have this beautiful scene of Jesus seeing the villagers coming towards him, and he declares to his disciples, look how the fields are ripe for the harvest. And then we read that Jesus stayed 2 days among Samaritans. He teaches them, and many come to faith. This whole story tells us something about the nature of the gospel and about Jesus himself. Jesus knowingly and willingly goes into the heart of Samaria among the people hated by his own people. The hatred was ingrained in his culture. Jesus also goes to a woman who would have been cast aside by any pious Jew as being someone who was irredeemable, a person who was lost and beyond all hope. And this passage reminds me that the message of God's love and salvation is never limited by our own prejudice. Jesus revealed himself to a woman whose past we would not easily accept. It also tells me that any argument about which group possesses the place where God is truly worshiped is meaningless. Jesus offers a grace that transcends all the things that divide us as people. May I dare go so far as to suggest that God is offended by our ever thinking that any person is unworthy of God's love and forgiveness. It is presumptuous for us to think we have the authority to ever determine to whom God extends his love. C.S. Lewis once wrote about the scandal of grace. In commenting on John chapter 4, he stated that the offer of salvation to the Samaritan woman was offensive to Jesus' disciples. No Christian teaching is more offensive to our sense of fairness than forgiveness. Grace is given to those who need it, friend and enemy alike. God is all about tearing down walls and making enemies into good neighbors. Unfortunately, our world is slow to adopt this same posture. And frankly, even we followers of Christ struggle to implement fully the grace God wants us to extend to this world. There are examples, lots of them, of the absurdity of what we think are critical differences among people. I came across one absurdity that involved a famous movie personality. You remember Groucho Marx? You know who he is? It would seem that the daughter of comedian Groucho Marx was once denied admittance to an exclusive country club's swimming pool with her friends, because her family were not members of that country club. And realizing what had happened, embarrassed officials, because Marx was famous, sent officials over to the Marx family to apologize, and they came with an application to join the country club. Groucho declined the invitation with this comment: "I wouldn't want to belong to any club that would have me as a member." Now, someone still tried to smooth over the incident by persuading the comedian to allow an application to be submitted for membership. But the country club was further embarrassed when the application was denied. What was the reason? Does anybody know? Well, Groucho Marx is Jewish, and the club was a restricted club. And true to form, Groucho wrote back after he'd received his decline letter: "My wife is not Jewish. Can she go swimming? And let our daughter wade up to her waist?" But how is it any less absurd to arbitrarily ban whole groups of people from country clubs, communities, neighborhoods, churches, or countries based on things that we cannot control ourselves, like our ethnicity, or whether we worship in a church or a mosque or synagogue? When it comes to dispensing grace, Jesus cares not one whit about the history of our people. He doesn't even care about your own history that much. All he cares about is whether or not you're thirsty. Or more clearly, do you understand what you are thirsty for? All people thirst for something that will last, something that will continually renew us. We are all like the woman at the well: "Sir, give me some of this water." The whole world is screaming to slake its thirst. The whole world is screaming to experience some hope. And instead of offering the refreshing hope we have, we categorize and exclude folks. And our exclusion, believe it or not, only really ends up punishing us. I have been fascinated and hopeful for Syrian refugees, especially when I read an update this week in the Toronto Star on March the 14th about a man named Tariq Haddad. Tariq Haddad has opened a chocolate shop in Halifax called Peace by Chocolate. The Prime Minister mentioned his business at the United Nations last year, and Peace by Chocolate cannot keep up with the orders for their chocolate now. Haddad was speaking about the culture shock of moving to Nova Scotia from 3 years in a refugee camp in Lebanon. He says that the local people were so welcoming, and he wanted to give back to the community by doing what he was trained to do, make chocolate. He even sent some of the profits from last year to Fort McMurray to help those who were in trouble because of the fires. Haddad says that he hopes his experience will show that when we accept newcomers, everybody wins. What a wonderful story, except for one thing. Peace by Chocolate isn't here in Simcoe. See, good things happen when we set aside those things we think should separate us as people. But Jesus is focused on the work he was sent to do. And this interchange occurs when the people of Sychar are streaming out of their homes to come and meet Jesus at the well. And Jesus says to his disciples, four more months and then comes the harvest. But I tell you, look around. See how the fields are ripe for harvesting. This is not a parable. He's saying literally, look and see the people who are coming to Jesus. What do we see when we see the people of Simcoe? What goes through our minds and our hearts when we see those heartbreaking pictures of desperate people on flimsy rubber boats in the Mediterranean, or those who are walking hundreds of miles, all looking for hope? It doesn't matter that they speak another language, or they come from a different country, or even if they have a different religion, they are all ripe for the harvest. They are all thirsting for someone, anyone, to offer them a cold drink, offer them some hope. Jesus said, anyone who drinks of this water, meaning H2O, will be thirsty again, but those who drink the water that I give them will never be thirsty. The water that I will give will become in them a spring of water gushing up to eternal life. What could be more needful in every heart? In every human heart, it is time to offer this thirsty world the only source of true water to quench their souls. His name is Jesus.